12 different approaches because everybody starts somewhere different. Everybody has a different set of assumptions of what they're willing to agree to and believe in. And in our world today, those assumptions are more varied and diverse than at any time in recent, any time in your lifetime. There has never been a time in recent memory when the individual views of the people you meet were more diverse than they are today. What do they believe in? What do they believe truth is? Is there such a thing as absolute truth? Is there absolute right and wrongs? Is there this? Is there that? Can I believe the Bible? Can I believe anything? Radically different answers to all of those questions, depending on who you talk to today, including people that grow up in our churches. Let me just put it there. Sometimes we kind of assume there's a level playing field out here and everybody's on the same page because you show up at this building, and that's not true either. People sit in this room and have questions, and that's great that they do. This is the place to come with your questions. I've been in dialogue with a young lady, it's going back almost 2 years now. She grew up in a Church of Christ like this one, went to Church of Christ College, Freed Hardeman, and got her degree, and is quite convinced that she doesn't believe in God anymore. And you say, how does that happen? And it has to do with some assumptions that she's made along the way and some things that I think she's been misled about. But by and large, the assumptions she's willing to grant aren't the ones that you might think that she should be. And she grew up in one of our churches. And you say, well, how did that happen? Well, that's a discussion for another day. How did that happen? But it has happened. And it's the quickly moving world out there. And so we need to have as many tools in our toolbox as possible. Okay? If you have one job as a carpenter, maybe you only need one tool. But for those of you guys that are fix-it men, you know you need as many tools as you can get your hand on, because that next job may be a little different than the last one. And that's the way we are when it comes to explaining God to people. The next person you meet may be a little different. So know what? We're going to have another tool. We'll try something new. And maybe there's some of these that will work for some of you, and others of you are going to hear them and say, that made no sense to me whatsoever. That's fine. It wasn't for you. I've got more. We've got 12 of them. We'll just keep on going. Tonight, we're going to look at what I'm calling the philosophical approaches. So the first time we looked at the classic arguments, and then we looked at the kind of science-y-based arguments last week. Tonight are the more philosophical ones, and then just to kind of give you a heads up, next week we'll finish up our 12 approaches and look at the Christian-based ones. Are there any reasons that Christians believe in God that are different than, say, a Muslim or a Jewish person believes in God? Is there anything on our side that helps us even more because of the God we believe in? And the answer is next week, yes. I think there are some advantages to being a Christian in that discussion, obviously. I would think that because I'm a Christian, so of course I would believe that. You'd find it strange if I didn't, right? So we'll talk about that next week. But tonight, the philosophical approaches. And what we're going to do, I've got three approaches tonight. We're going to take three arguments. We're going to start with the most mind-numbingly complex and then move towards simpler and then simpler still. Okay. So the first one we're going to talk about is so painfully obscure that I almost skipped it tonight, but I thought, you know, it might help somebody. I've never met that person. I've never met the person that said, I didn't believe in God, but then I heard the ontological argument, and suddenly I did. But there's somebody out there who did, so we're going to go ahead and cover it, and then we'll get simpler and simpler. So if you don't like the first one, that's okay. I'm not a big fan. It kind of works, but it's tricky. So the first argument is very old. It comes from Anselm, from the 11th century in Christian history. And I've got a quote, but that's actually only part of the quote. The quote comes from a prayer. He was writing down a prayer. The quote starts with, "And so, Lord, do you who gives understanding to faith, give me, so far as you know it to be profitable, to understand that you are as we believe, and that you are that which we believe, and indeed we believe that you are a being than which nothing greater can be conceived." So he's saying a prayer like the Psalms, and in the prayer he's talking about who he believes God is and who God has revealed himself to be. And in the middle of this prayer, I don't know, you could call it an accident if you want, but he stumbles upon this very interesting idea. What does it mean to say we believe God is the greatest possible being? Or as he just said it, he is a being that than which nothing greater could be thought. Now, there's some tricky English for you. a being that than which nothing greater could be thought. In other words, you think of the greatest possible being you can think of. If you can think of a more possible being, or a greater possible being, then you haven't got to God yet. He has to be the ultimate in every conceivable category to be God. And so he's saying this in his prayer that he's writing down in one of his journals that we still have. And then he comes to this little line and starts up there on the screen. Even the fool, where is that at? Yep, here it is. Okay. Even the fool is convinced that something exists in the understanding, at least, than which nothing greater can be conceived. For when he hears of this, he understands it, and whatever is understood exists in the understanding. And assuredly that than which nothing greater can be conceived cannot exist in the understanding alone. For suppose it exists in the understanding alone, then it can be conceived to exist in reality, which is greater. Okay, well, that's kind of strange. What is his argument? He says, even if you don't believe in God, you don't believe in what? God. Okay, so you have an idea of this thing called God. Okay? It exists at least in your imagination. Okay? Where does that idea come from? And is that a real idea? Is your idea of God the greatest possible being? Well, if it's the greatest possible being, does the greatest possible being exist or not? If it doesn't exist, well, then it's not the greatest thing you could imagine, because you can imagine something greater. It'd be something that exists. So the greatest possible thing you can imagine has to be something that's real, or else you could imagine something greater. Well, then I guess it's real. And he closes the book and moves on. For those of us who don't like it, and I'm one of those who feel wishy-washy about it, it feels like kind of a word game. And atheists feel like you're tricking them. You know, they feel like, well, I can imagine a unicorn. Doesn't mean there's such a thing as a unicorn. But what he's trying to say is there such a thing as a being so great it must exist because the idea of it exists? Is there an idea so grand that it could not have been postulated by the human imagination, that the fact that the idea exists, the being itself must exist? And that's been toyed with through the years. All the great names in human philosophy have taken a crack at it, because everyone's quite sure there's something wrong with the argument, and everyone struggles to figure out what it is, because it's slippery. Immanuel Kant was quite convinced he had defeated it, and then someone came along later and said, yeah, but what about this? Oh, well, yeah. So if you pick up an apologetics textbook, you're going to get the ontological argument somewhere in it. That's it. If you like it, great. If you don't like it, that's quite okay. You're in good company, because we're going to move on. But that's the idea, that there is an idea so great, the very idea indicates that there must be something that created that idea. It's too great an idea to exist without reality behind it. Okay. Didn't expect you to wile over that one, because it's just, yeah. This one's a little better. The human intellect argument is actually, I think, a very important one. Don't read that yet. Let's talk about humanistic evolution and what it means to be a creature that evolved from amoeba to man evolution, or from atoms to molecules evolution. What would it mean to be that kind of creature? Here's a goofy question. If your dog told you something, well, first of all, we'd have a talk about that. I understand. But if your dog told you something, would you believe it? Do you trust your dog's sense of rationality? Do you expect your dog to come to good intellectual conclusions? I don't know if dogs even think in the way that we think of thinking. But if they did, do we think it's a really believable conclusion they come to? One of the concerns we have about evolution then is, if I am the descendant of lesser intellectual beings, what does that mean about me? Darwin himself, in Origin of the Species, had this question. Charles Darwin said, the haunting question always comes back to me. If I don't trust the monkey brain, why do I trust my brain? And he kept coming back to it, and it really bothered him. if I think I am the descendant of primates, and I don't trust what primates think, why do I trust what I think? And yet, every day, human intellect proves to be this incredibly powerful thing. Human intellect can look at mathematics and solve equations. Human intellect can fix a truck. Human intellect can solve medical mysteries. Human intellect can write a poem. Human intellect can do science. Right? I mean, that's what evolution is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about science, right? Human intellect is required to do science. So if my idea about where humans come from is that our intellect comes from something I don't trust, well, that bothers me. Here's the way mathematics professor Davies says it. I'll give you his quote. "We human beings are able to grasp at least some of nature's secrets. We have cracked part of the cosmic code. Why this should be, just why Homo sapiens, and that's you, should carry the spark of rationality that provides the key to the universe is deep enigma. We who are children of the universe, animated stardust, can nevertheless reflect on the nature of that same universe, even to the extent of glimpsing the rules on which it runs. How we have become linked into this cosmic dimension is a mystery, yet the linkage cannot be denied." He's a mathematics professor, and he's saying, I'm not sure how we think about things. How is that possible? How do you accumulate enough stardust and minerals and molecules to produce a rational thought? And if it did, would you trust that thought? And yet you trust your thought every day. This can be taken a step further in evolutionary theory. Would you trust a caveman? We've all seen the Geico commercial. So simple, even a caveman can do it. Okay? Would you trust a caveman to do your taxes? Would you trust a caveman to make good moral decisions? We're not even talking about monkeys or primates or anything. Would you trust that being? Well, why not? See the problem? If I don't trust that being, and my intellect is just a step above his, I'm just a little further down the evolutionary chain, and I'm not just doing caveman stuff, we're building spaceships. Okay, maybe evolution can make a mind that's able to hunt down game. Let's give it credit. Evolutionary theory can explain why an animal would develop an instinct to hunt, to find shelter, to reproduce. Yeah, but is that all humans do? Hunt, find shelter, and reproduce? We do art. We build spaceships. We hunt Pokemon. Right? We do things that have no survival value whatsoever, and we use our brains to engage it. We do philosophy. We have classes on apologetics and think really hard thoughts that hurt our heads. Why do we trust any of that? The fact that we believe human intellect works seems to demonstrate that we think it has a source above just kind of natural causes, because we don't trust anything else's natural causes. Richard Dawkins has a huge problem with this in his book on the God Delusion. It's bestseller year after year. The God Delusion is maybe the most famous book in America right now on atheism. And here's his argument. He says, I know you Christians think you have reasons to believe in God, but the reason you have reasons to believe in God is because your brain's messed up. Evolution produced some defects in your brain, and that's why you think the way that you do. Evolution favors people who think about God and stuff. So you have delusions. It's a byproduct of evolution. Well, what's the problem with that? The same brain that's messed up from evolution is reading his book. The same brain that's messed up by evolution wrote his book. So why would I believe anything the human brain does if I can't trust anything the human brain does? The very fact that we trust the brain, that it has intellectual thought. Human beings are the universe thinking about itself. That's weird. And yet here we are. Okay, well, that was kind of complicated still. So let's get to the simplest of all the philosophical arguments. This one is actually my favorite. This is the one, if you clear the board and you set me in a room with a person and I know nothing else, this is actually one of the places I'm going to start, and it's called the moral argument. And so if the other two just had no appeal to you, I hope this one does. We start with the question because we want to know what is the person we're talking to willing to believe. And we ask a question. Is there anything in the universe of human actions that you believe is actually, truly wrong? And you let them pick. It doesn't even matter if it makes sense. They can pick something absurd. I think it's wrong to wear plaid shirts. Right? It doesn't matter what they think, right? They can pick anything. Do you believe there is actually anything wrong in the universe? Yes. What is it? They name it. It doesn't matter. Okay. If they say no, I don't believe anything's wrong, then you take their lunch money. Okay. Right? Yeah. Everybody believes it's wrong to do wrong to them, right? I mean, everybody believes it's wrong to take my stuff. But no, more seriously, you can suggest something if you'd like. Rape is a really good example because rape is one of those things that makes us all cringe. And so there's not a lot of people out there who are willing to say, you know, rape could be okay in some circumstances. Most people, even rapists, I suspect, are willing to say that, yeah, probably there is a wrong. Rape would have to be one of those. If it doesn't make you too creepy to do it, you can also make the suggestion, what about molesting small children? Okay, most sane people that you talk to, do you believe it's absolutely wrong in every circumstance to molest a small child? Is there any circumstance where it would be okay to molest a small child? Most people you're going to talk to are going to say, that one's too far. That one's completely wrong. Okay. So the point is, number one, we want to establish, is there anything, and it doesn't matter what it is, that you would agree is wrong every time? And then you're going to ask this question. You're going to want to write this down because this is a hard one to remember. Here's your question. Why? And then you're going to shut up. And you're not going to say anything else. And you're just going to wait for the person to come up with a reason. What reason could there be? Let's take rape as our example. Why is it wrong in every case to perform an act of rape? Let's put on our thinking caps for a moment. Pretend you're not Christians and you've never read the Bible. Why would you believe rape is wrong? Can you think of any reasons that somebody might say, well, maybe? It hurts another person. Maybe rape's wrong because it hurts another person. Why is it always wrong to hurt another person? Huh? Violation of somebody else's body. Why is it always wrong to violate somebody else's body? Because you don't want it to happen to you. Is it okay for other people? I mean, this is just you. You would be okay if it happened to somebody else, right? No. Oh. So it's not just about you. Why is it wrong to violate somebody else's body? It doesn't hurt you. Why is it wrong to violate a complete stranger's body? Or why is it wrong to do harm to another person? Or why is it wrong to commit rape? Pick any of those questions. We're still really on the same question, right? We've got one thing. We've just changed the name of it from rape to hurting a person to violating their body. We're still asking, why is that wrong? Notice I didn't have any complicated questions there. I just said why every time you said something and repeated it back to you. Why? Can anyone think of a reason that we haven't named? Every life has value. Why? Why does every life have value? Because we're created by God. You cheated. Yeah. That's where we're going to end up. We've got a quick answer for that question. We go back to Genesis 1 and we're made in the image of God. And we shut our Bible and we're saying, done. Finished. Right? But I cheated and I took away the Bible to start with. So, sorry about that. Why does every life value? Why is there a value to every life? Hmm? Okay. They do. Well, I agree. People do have a standard. And I'm asking, where does that come from and why? So I'm guessing most people think rape is wrong. Why? Well, can I give you some possibilities and let's kick them around a minute? Maybe it's wrong because it's illegal. Right? I mean, we're a nation of laws, and rape is illegal. So maybe things that are illegal are wrong. And the converse of that would be things that are legal are okay. Well, what's the problem with that? Well, there's been a few times in history where really bad things were legal. Can you name a few? Slavery? Currently, I would still put abortion on that list. It's a thing that's legal in our nation that I still think is abhorrent, but we don't have to even talk about that one because I understand some people might argue with you about it and you don't want to get off subject. In Nazi Germany, was it legal to put a Jewish person into a very hot furnace and incinerate them to look for gold inside they might have swallowed? Not only was it legal, it was what the government told you to do if you were a soldier. When they took them to the Nuremberg trials, the SS soldiers and so forth, know what their argument was? We were following orders. It was legal in Germany to burn Jews. We were doing what we were supposed to do. And yet we convicted them and said it's wrong to do that. Interesting. Lenora? The other problem is legal and illegal are determined by people, and they change from time to time. Talk about Roe v. Wade, or we could talk about slavery, or we could talk about, you know, pick your topic. What's legal changes. So you're saying it's absolutely wrong unless we vote on it tomorrow? If tomorrow we had a vote and 51% of Americans said rape is now legal, are you telling me it's be okay now? Okay, so it's not laws. Let's get laws out of here. Forget laws. Culture. Maybe even underneath our laws we have a cultural ethic that we just understand and our parents taught us and their parents taught us, and that's where right and wrong comes from. Okay, that's interesting. That might work. That works fine as long as everybody's parents teach them the same thing. What if your parents taught you to be a cannibal? What if your culture taught you to rape? Are there cultures in human history that thought rape was a fine thing to do? Yeah, not very long ago. Okay, well, the culture doesn't work. You see, there are cultures that today think that. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And eventually, if you go back far enough, I've got to explain that first person that told their kid rape was wrong, where did they get that idea from? I still don't have an answer. Can you think of any other options? Why is rape absolutely wrong? See the problem here? This is a very useful argument because, number one, most people, if you really push them, will agree that there's at least one thing they can think of that's always wrong. Again, if they say no, you take their lunch money and you run. And if they get mad, you say too bad, because it's okay. It's okay for me. My ethical standard says it's okay to take your lunch money. But most people will say, yeah, okay, there's at least one thing that's wrong. Always, every time wrong. And then it's simple because you just ask why. And no one has done any better to explain this. I'm picking your brains, but I can give you philosophy textbooks written by atheists who, if you read far enough in, come to the same questions and have no answer. Jürgen Habermas, I think is his name, probably the most famous of the German atheists of the last century, said, when we get rid of Jewish and Christian ethical values, everything else is just talk. And he's an atheist. He said, when you get rid of Jewish and Christian ethical values, everything else is just us talking, because we don't know where everything else comes from. We're still, even as an atheist, he says, I'm borrowing Jewish and Christian ethical ideas, because as an atheist, I've got nowhere else to go for them. See the problem? I've got nowhere else to go. I got to watch this great video, and if you're curious, you can send me an email or something. I'll send you the link. It's a fantastic little video, and it's this atheist, moral, he's a philosopher at a philosophy department at a famous university. I think it's Harvard, maybe. I can't remember. But he's a big shot in atheism and philosophy. And he's sitting next to a couple of Christian apologists on this debate platform, and they're talking. And they ask him, is slavery wrong? And he wiggles like a politician. I mean, he could run for office. It's fantastic. He says, well, it would be, I think it's wrong I wouldn't want a slave, and I don't think you should have... What was his problem? He knows where this is going. And he just wiggles back and forth. And finally he says, yeah, slavery's wrong. And the other guy on stage says, why? And then he just sits there quietly and yields the rest of his time. And he lets the atheist say anything he wants because nothing he says. The audience at one point actually starts laughing. An audience of intellectual people starts laughing because the atheist explanation of something as simple as why is slavery wrong was laughable when you really start digging that hole. The Assyrians thought it was okay. Why was it wrong for the Assyrians? Because here's this funny thing. He was complaining and saying, you shouldn't believe the Bible because there's slavery in it. And the Christian says, what's wrong with slavery? Slavery is wrong. Why? If you don't have the Bible, you don't care about slavery because there's no reason to think it's wrong in the first place. And this is what C.S. Lewis said about it. He said, C.S. Lewis, if you didn't know, started out as an atheist. And his reason for being an atheist, among others, was his belief that the world had evil in it and a good God wouldn't allow there to be evil. But then here was his problem, and here's his quote that I love. He says, let me read it carefully. I'll just read it off the screen. My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust, but how had I got this idea of just and unjust? If the whole show was bad and senseless from A to Z, so to speak, why did I, who was supposed to be part of the show, find myself in such violent reaction against it? Why am I worried about there being evil in the universe if I can't even tell you what evil is? See, when you take God out of it, there's no such thing as evil. So I can't even complain about it. Baton Rouge, more cops were shot today, or last night, or whenever it happened. Is it evil? Well, if you're an atheist, I can't even tell you why. I can't even complain about it. Richard Dawkins, again, famous atheist, he complains about Islam all the time. He's British, and he's very adamant that they need to throw all the Muslims out of Britain. I mean, they're the problem. He says religion is the problem. It's violent. It's awful. And he complains about it. Why is Muslim killing British people wrong? He can't give you an answer. He's just quite convinced it's a bad idea. There's a great episode in his life. Richard Dawkins is always doing something foolish, so he's my favorite atheist. He's always doing something embarrassing. And he made a big deal. There was a cricket game where the British player cheated. And everyone knew it, but the ref didn't see it. I don't understand cricket. He could have cheated right in front of me. I wouldn't have understood. But everyone saw it, understood it, complained about it, and the ref didn't see it. And Richard Dawkins just threw a fit. Why our national pride and our great sport is under attack by this act of crime, and this guy cheated, and I can't believe that. And people said, why would you care? Why is it wrong to cheat at cricket? You live in a world where you can't be certain it's wrong to rape someone and you're worried about cricket? And that's really the absurdity of atheism, that there's just nothing you can say is absolutely wrong. Now, what are some of the responses you might get to this? What the clever atheist will try to do is confuse the subject. I'm asking the question, is there anything that's absolutely wrong? They'll come back with the question, can you always know what's right and wrong? Now, that's a different question, isn't it? Are there circumstances where it's really hard to tell? I mean, I like to think the Bible tells me what to do, and I try to listen to what God says in the book. But are there days where I look at it and say, boy, that's just a tough one? And I go home and study some more and pray, and I'm still confused. And I try the next day. And I try. Are there days like that? There sure are. Are there questions of ethics that even Christians disagree on? Yeah, absolutely. That's not the same question of asking, is anything right and wrong? Even if I don't know what it is anything in the universe absolutely wrong every time? Can I name even one thing that's wrong every time? And as long as you can say yes to that, then I've got to have a reason why. Now, what is the Christian's answer to this? Christian's got a simple answer. Christian says we are made by a moral God. We believe one of the chief characteristics of God, we read about it in the Psalm 97, is that he's a moral being. He loves righteousness. He hates unrighteousness. He has this character, and he's the one who made us. He's the gold standard of what right and wrong is. And we're made in his image. And so even without a Bible, I haven't even opened a Bible yet, have I? I've just said, we're created by God. Already I've got a grounds for right and wrong. There's someone out there who made me, and he might have an opinion about that. Then sure enough, I open my Bible, and it turns out he's got quite a few opinions about that. And they're not opinions, they're commandments. And he says, these things are right and these things are wrong. Okay. So the Christian has lots of ways to talk about this. And even though, yes, some days it is hard to know the difference on some really tricky questions, bioethics. I had to read something on bioethics, and I still don't know. I'm still confused. You'd have to have a PhD in bioethics to read the book on bioethics. It's utterly a confusing field. Yeah, there are questions about end-of-life decisions, beginning-of-life decisions. Those are complicated questions. But the fact that there's some area out there where I'm confused doesn't mean that there isn't something that's right and wrong that I can see it. It's wrong to commit rape. It's wrong to harm little children. Okay. And even the atheist is quite certain of that. It's actually one of the first things we learn as children. I don't even know if we learn it. I don't think we have to tell children. Go to any playground anywhere in the world. Anywhere. Find a kid 5 years old. Watch him play a game, any game, for like 5 minutes. And at some point, one of those children will shout at the top of their lungs, "You cheated, that's not fair." What does that mean? What that child is asserting is, this game has a set of rules, and it's not right to violate those rules. Has he had a course in American jurisprudence and the rule of law and the American Constitution? Does he understand the cultural precedent of rules and game playing from the Assyrians or the Aztecs or something? Where did he get that idea? Kids come prepackaged with it. They may not understand it, and maybe we don't understand it still, but they get that there are rules and you're supposed to play by rules. That's the rules. Where do they come from? Where did we get that idea? It's a staggering thing. Any questions or thoughts on morality and why it makes such a good, powerful case? I didn't have to open my Bible to make that argument, although it helps when I do. Yeah, Jim, go ahead. Yeah, we have, yeah. Yeah. This is a really good, what you've done is you flipped it upside down and made just a perfectly good argument out of it too. I've asked, is there anything that's actually wrong? Jim wants to know, is there anything actually right? Is it right to want other people to be treated well, to be treated like me? Is it right to have compassion for other people? Where does that come from, this idea that you should feel compassion for a person other than yourself? Obviously not everybody's got it, or at least we choose to ignore it. But when you talk about it, people get it. Yeah. Yeah, but it didn't bother me. Why? Why? See, yeah. Yeah, see, if I'm completely in a world without God in it, I do have to ask the question. Why does it matter that a primate in Baton Rouge was killed? Primates are killed all the time. If I'm the process of a result of naturalistic evolution, we talk about rape. Why does it bother me that some mammal raped another mammal? Why do I care? It wasn't me. Why do we care about Baton Rouge? Where does this compassion and empathy come from? It's a strange thing. Makes perfect sense if you're made in the image of God. It makes no sense if you're not. Because in evolution, it's the advantage of surviving that carries on. Caring for other people isn't a survival skill. In fact, quite often, caring for other people gets you killed, doesn't it? Why does a fireman run into a burning building? Better question. What is the evolutionary advantage of a fireman running into a burning building? Does it help him survive? Survival of the fittest. Is he more likely to survive by running into burning buildings? So we ask this question, where does this develop? That's not a survival instinct. That's the opposite of a survival instinct. Where does that come from, this morality, this virtue? You can expand this argument to actually things beyond morality. A version of this that I used with a young guy, I was really having trouble with him because he didn't believe in anything. Do you believe there's absolute right and wrong? I was to the point of stealing his lunch money. I mean, he couldn't name anything that he thought was wrong. Just really could not find anything that I could get a hold of and say, okay, let's start there. And so finally, he was dating a young lady, and she was attractive. I said, do you think she's beautiful? Well, yeah, because he's smart. He's not going to say no. That's a dumb answer. So yeah, she was there. Yeah, she's beautiful. I said, do you believe beauty is an actual thing? Yeah. What is beauty? What is the evolutionary advantage of beauty? Is it a real thing? Does it exist? Why do we believe in it? Two cavemen, let's go back to our favorite cavemen, Fred Flintstone and Barney. Two cavemen walk out on a snowy field, beautiful, perfect mountain vista. One of them stares at it and says, this is beautiful. The other one goes inside, ignores it, and starts a fire. Which one survives? The guy who ignored it and started the fire. There's no evolutionary advantage of noticing beauty in nature. There's no evolutionary advantage of believing in the existence of actual beauty in the world. And yet, essentially, all humans do. All of us believe in something that we think is beautiful, that exists all on its own, beyond reproductive desire, just things that we find beautiful. Beautiful sky, a sunset, a piece of music. Why do we make music? There's no reason for that. So what this is basically asking is there anything in the human experience that we believe is real and not just a figment of our imagination that doesn't come from evolutionary processes? Morality, compassion, beauty, music and art. Where do these things come from? Primates don't make beautiful music. You know why? Because they don't care. It doesn't help them in their day. Their day isn't better because they played Tchaikovsky. Right? They're not better for it. They don't survive longer. So they don't do it. And here we are playing music. You can get a degree in music. What a waste of time. Why would you do that? Just kidding. Why would you do that? Why would you learn music? If you're an evolutionist, there is absolutely no reason. It's senseless. Okay. So I think this one is really important. That's all I want to say about that. Any other questions, comments on that? Jim, go ahead. Well, in the process, it's not a linear thing where A becomes B and B becomes C and C becomes C. You got a whole bunch of A's and some of them becomes a different kind of A and some of them becomes a little more like B. And so it's certainly possible to explain that things that look like things we came from could exist. I mean, I understand your question. I mean, you do wonder, if only the fittest thing survive, why isn't everything the fittest thing, right? Why does anything survive that's less fit than the thing that it evolved into? What in the world do little weenie dogs exist for? How do they exist? The same evolutionary process that weeded out the saber-toothed tiger kept poodles. Right? Why do things exist that don't seem to be particularly fit for anything? It's a good question. Yeah. Okay. I'm done. Next week, we actually get to talk about the Bible a little bit. So if you've been waiting for that, we'll get there. We'll start on the Christian evidences for why there is a God. We'll talk about the resurrection. We're going to talk about Christian experience and ask the question, could you feel or perceive something as a Christian that might convince you there is a God? We'll talk about that. And then we'll ask about Christian community. Is there anything that the church does that could convince people there is a God, even without any of the intellectual arguments I just made? And we'll talk about that next week. Thank you. Thank you.